I'd like to settle down, but they won't let me. Going around the world, I gotta find my girl. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert's bare, man.
It's time to head out on the road and grab a slice of Americana. It's the Nocturnal Journey on 720 WGN.
Welcome back. Late last summer, I went to San Francisco and checked in. I'd been there before when they first opened the Beat Museum. It's really at ground zero there in North Beach in San Francisco at 540 Broadway, right by Vesuvio's, a great, great little tavern, and right by City Lights Books where Kerouac and all the Beats hung out, and they'd go over to Vesuvio's. So I hooked up with my old friend Jerry Cimino, who started the Beat Museum, and things are going great. And here's Jerry with a little bit of the history of his project.
When did you open this up?
Actually, I opened up the Beat Museum in 2003. The idea came to me. My wife and I had been traveling in Amsterdam. There's a hemp museum in Amsterdam.
I've actually been there.
And I said, you know what?
Sex museum too, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. And I said to my wife, you know, if they can have a hemp museum in Amsterdam, why can't we have a beat museum in San Francisco? And she says, you know, that's a pretty cool idea. And that's how it came about.
And, I mean, so what was your step? How did you secure this property? Tell us the address. And we're in the heart of
We're directly across the street from City Lights Bookstore at Broadway in Columbus. Our street address is 540 Broadway in San Francisco. Literally, City Lights is 50 feet away.
This is ground zero.
It is ground zero. Yeah, Lawrence Ferlinghetti likes to call it the center of the universe. Because everything happens in North Beach.
And tell us about the space, what it was in its previous life, and how you secured it.
The cool thing about North Beach is all the buildings were built after the 1906 earthquake, because the whole city burned down for the most part. And so this neighborhood basically looks the exact same way it would have looked when Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac were walking these streets back in the 40s and the 50s. And what's really cool about it is those same buildings are standing today. Now, the building we're in was, at one time, was built in 1912, and it was called the Swiss American Hotel. And there's a lot of rooms upstairs. People still live in these rooms upstairs today. And some of the Beats would have stayed in this place.
Oh, I didn't know that. You didn't tell me when we talked before. Yeah.
And then downstairs is, it used to be, the space we occupy used to be a restaurant called New Joe's. And it was, you know, basic dinner fare, kind of inexpensive, and the Beats would have eaten here because everybody used to eat here.
Interesting. Now, Ferlinghetti being across the street. And
directly
stuff,
across the
street. Where I'm going with this is how much when you opened, what year did you open?
We opened in 2003 when I was in Monterey, and he was very supportive of what we did.
That's where I'm going. I mean, oral histories. What did these people tell you about, and how did that inform the museum?
Well, a big part of our story came about just from people walking in the door and handing us stuff. This belonged to Gregory Corso. There's a book there signed by Ferlinghetti to Gregory Corso, which is very cool. Somebody gave that to us. He was a roommate of Gregory's, and Gregory left it behind, so he walked in and gave it to us. This is a jacket that belonged to Jack Kerouac.
Tell us about that jacket. We're on radio, so describe it for me.
It's a CPO jacket. It's from the mid-1950s, and they were big in New England. It was a label in New England, and it's the type of jacket Kerouac, everybody in New England would have worn these. And Kerouac had this during the Dharma Bums era. And there's a photograph of him wearing the jacket. He might have climbed the mountain with that jacket on, actually. It's kind of cool.
And when did you get that?
A young man walked in the door one day and said, I got to talk to you. I got something really cool, and I don't know what to do with it. And he owned it, and he had the certificate of authenticity.
Yeah, how do you verify that?
He purchased it at auction from the estate, and it was a direct lineage from John Sampas, who was the estate of Kerouac, the executor. And he had the paperwork documenting that it was real, and there just happens to be a photograph of Jack wearing the same thing. So we're pretty confident that it's the real thing.
Tell me about that picture you just showed me of Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah, it's a really interesting shot. It was in Time magazine in either 58 or 59 of Jackie Kennedy on the family plane. It's not Air Force One because JFK hasn't even been elected yet. It's the family plane, and JFK is sitting in one seat eating some clam chowder. I'm sure it's Boston clam chowder. And Jackie is sitting next to him with her feet up reading a book, and the book is Jack Kerouac's Dharma Bums, which is pretty cool because Dharma Bums, a lot of people don't know this, but Dharma Bums is probably the one piece of literature that is responsible for a proliferation of Americans investigating other religions. Prior to this, nobody knew anything about Zen Buddhism in America, mm-hmm. unless they were born into it, typically Chinese or Japanese. But Caucasians and most Americans literally knew nothing about Zen Buddhism. Here, Jack Kerouac writes a book about it, and it becomes a bestseller in 1958. And then all of a sudden, everybody wants to be a Zen lunatic. And everybody studies, you know, Buddhism or you know, various other types of religious and spirituality these days. But in the 50s, it was quite rare.
You know, that's, I'm going to go off the subject here a little bit, but I want to ask you about your demographics here. And I've been coming out here a long time. And on this trip, I've been out here a few days. And I hang out at Vesuvio's and sure. I go to City Lights and stuff. It's really skewing younger. I'm really seeing a lot
Absolutely.
Of younger. I'm seeing a lot of younger people not from America and stuff. Can right. you talk about the themes of the beats, how it resonates with younger people? I mean, travel, search for identity.
You're hitting on it exactly yeah. because the themes of the beats really are youthful. It's exactly what you said. It's a search for identity. It's looking for kicks. It's what is my sexual identity? And basically, I like to say that the beats were at the forefront of every major social movement that young people today pretty much take for granted, like racial equality and gender equality, treating the girls just like you treat the boys, gay and lesbian rights. I mean, we would call Ginsburg a gay advocate. Before there was a term gay,
right.
I mean, and even things like environmentalism. Gary Snyder, Michael McClure writing poetry about saving the whales, saving the dolphins in the 50s. So everything that a young person today considers to be normal, they find it in the beats. And we do get a tremendous amount of young people coming into the Beat Museum. We have a very much of an enviable demographic. Most museums would die to have our demographics because... most museums get people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. We get people in their teens and their 20s and their 30s, which is phenomenal. And they do come from all over the world. Every single day we meet somebody coming in from France or Brazil or we get a lot of Chinese these days. It's amazing what's happening with China and all the people from China who know about this stuff. Now, here's an interesting point that I recently discovered, kind of came upon in my own thought process about 3 or 5 years ago. I believe the reason that the Beat Generation became so famous is they were the very first counterculture to come of age with electronic media.
Right.
Every society has its counterculture. Greeks and Romans had their countercultures. Emerson and Thoreau and the Transcendentalists of the 1800s, they had the printed word. But they did not have radio and television.
I've written that Kerouac became like the first writer celebrity on television because of his thing with Steve Allen.
That's right. It's
yeah.
really true.
Yeah, yeah.
And plus he was so good looking.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so that whole celebrity culture, really, you could trace part of that back to Jack, because one of the things we say as people walk up the stairs here is what Elvis was to music, what James Dean and Brando were to film, Kerouac and the Beats were to literature. They were the bad boys. Some of them were extremely good looking. And it kind of stuck with the American consciousness. And then because U.S. media is so dominant around the world, everybody watches our movies. That's one of the things I've learned just running the Beat Museum, because we get so many people coming in from so many different places. They all know our films. They all know our TV shows.
Yeah.
And so because of that, they really dig on the culture. And then when they start tracing their favorite person, like Bob Dylan or Johnny Depp or Patti Smith, and they realize those guys were influenced by Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. And that's when they really dig into the beats.
Yeah, yeah. How many items do you have here?
You know, I really couldn't tell
Over
you.
Over a thousand.
Thousands.
Thousands, yeah.
And this is just what's on display. We got a lot of stuff in the archives. The truth of the matter is, if I had five times the space that we have today, we could fill it. I got so many exhibits just sitting in file drawers that we aren't even in a position to display because we don't have the space.
We'll be back with more of Jerry Cimino in the Beat Museum after this.
Some people like to rock, some people like to roll.
But me, I like to sit around. Welcome back to our little travel segment here on Nocturnal Journal 720 WGN, where we shoot out to San Francisco and the Beat Museum. Dan Long, have you ever been to San Francisco?
I have not. It's on my to-do list, though.
It's a good thing to go see the Cubs out there. But Jack Kerouac once said he spent a week there and he had the beatest time of his life. So Jerry Cimino, the founder of the Beat Museum, will fill us in on that right now.
I don't remember last time. Was there a gift shop there last time? And I remember, I mean, tell us what you got in there. I mean, I saw the Jack bobbleheads.
Yeah. Well, we saw all the books, of
the
course.
Books.
And we
saw
movies and T-shirts and posters. And everything's got a beat-related theme. We're heavy on the hippie stuff, too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as your listeners, I'm sure, would know, or maybe they don't, but it'll make perfect sense to them. The Beat Generation later became the Beatniks, and then the Beatniks became the hippies of the 1960s. Before they went to Haight-Ashbury, the hippies were here in North Beach. And it was the same group of people. It was a natural evolution. And so we sell all kinds of ancillary items, and that's one of the ways we fund ourselves. Kerouac.com is our website.
Good.
Jack Kerouac's last name, Kerouac.com. And we sell a lot of items on the website, too. We ship them all over the world.
Our show's a lot about music, and this is a slam dunk question, but can you talk about the Beat's relationship with music and jazz and the rhythm of writing?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, sometimes I have people tell me that they have a little difficulty getting into On the Road or Dharma Bums. It's not their style of writing. And invariably I'll say, put on some Charlie Parker,
put on
some, you know, Miles Davis or something, and listen to the jazz that Jack would have been listening to, and you'll get the rhythm. You know, because it is a jazzy type of writing style. Jack took his style because of jazz music. He also took it from Neil Cassidy's writing as well. But if you think about jazz, you know, you got a spontaneous art form, and say you got a trio, and one guy's playing the keyboards, and one guy's playing a horn, and somebody else is playing a bass, and they start off on a combo, and then you flip it to a solo for the horn guy, and he flips it back to the bass, and all of a sudden it's over, and it's like, Jack thinks, why can't you write a book in that same fashion? And that's one of the ways he got his style.
Yeah,
and he called it bop spontaneous prose.
Yeah, yeah. Have you had musicians come in here? Have musicians donated stuff? What's your relationship with the music community?
It's pretty good. I would like it to be bigger.
I saw some Bob Dylan stuff down there.
Yeah, I would hope Bob would stop in.
I saw a guy at Vesuvio's last night who looked just like him.
Possibly.
He was off in the corner. Really? I know Van Morrison used to hang around here.
Yeah. City Lights is actually publishing a Van Morrison book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
And you hear about these celebrities stopping into City Lights.
Well, what's that Van Morrison book? There's a scoop for us, Dan. That's my producer.
It's over in the window at City Lights.
It's out already?
I don't believe it's out. I think it's a mock-up. It's in the window. But it's... I don't know if it's lyrics. I really don't know. I'm not that close to it. But Tom Waits was in here not too long ago.
Yeah,
we get our fair share of celebrities, movie people. Owen Wilson came in not too long ago. Penn Jillette, the magician, he came in. And he actually walked in the door and said, what's this all about? And it's like, well, I got to catch a plane. Maybe I'll make it one day. 20 minutes later, he was back and said, what happened to your plane? He says, I made it later. I have to see this. And he was really cool. He was really influenced by Ginsberg. In a big way.
Did he tell you how?
So you'll notice right over here, we have a photograph of a naked Allen Ginsberg and a naked Gregory Corso.
Uh-huh.
And I love the picture because it's very innocent and impish. And it's like, look, we're naked in the world. And when I was talking to Penn, I said, you know, Penn, before you go, can we get your photo? Because, you know, we'd like to get photos of celebrities. He goes, yeah, where do you want me? I said, how about over here next to Allen and Gregory? And he looks at it and he goes, oh, I can dig this. Honest to God, he starts taking his clothes off. And next thing you know, he's got his underwear laying at his around his ankles, and he's covering himself with his hands, and he's taking a picture with that photograph in the background.
It's a great story.
It's a cool story. It's on our website. I even said, Penn, I hope you're okay. We're going to put this on our website. He says, well, my manager probably won't like it, but I don't care.
This is a big topic with me back in Chicago. And I come out here about every year, year and a half. I just clip this out of the Examiner for free. About finding the unchanged San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I've read stories. I've read stories even about Chinatown.
Yeah,
about things changing and the internet, the computer people coming in just with all this money and stuff. Can you just riff a little bit? And this is really important to me in Chicago, and Chicago's changing fast too, but just about cultural preservation and what you're doing, and the value of memory of all this.
Yeah, I agree. There's you know, you've heard the term institutional memory. Well, there's social memory, there's neighborhood memory. And this is an important issue, I think, for everybody in every major city, because it's not only San Francisco, Chicago that's going through it. I mean, every major city's going through it to one degree or another. We're probably going through it on steroids out here because there's so much dot-com money that's
I've really noticed it on this visit.
I've noticed it a lot in the last few years. And we saw it coming because we gradually people that we knew were getting evicted from their apartments. And all of a sudden you'd hear rent went up from $2,000 a month to $4,000 a month overnight. And it's like, what's happening in the city? And this was a few years ago. And there's a lot to be said about cultural memory and preserving what came before. One of the things that a lot of these techies don't realize, I bet you 99% of them don't know it. You could literally say that the high-tech business, the way it exists today, came from the beat generation and the hippie culture. You know, most of these, not I don't want to say most, but an awful lot of the folks that have been involved in the high-tech world in years past, just embodied by Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was an acid head. You know, he had Dharma bums in his backpack when he was traveling India, and he wouldn't even interview somebody if they hadn't done LSD. So if you think about the connection between the Beats and their drug experimentation, of course, we don't advocate the use of any kind of illegal substances, but we recognize people do it. The whole counterculture of the Apple scene and think different and, you know, be the revolutionary. A lot of that comes from, you know, these counterculture people and the hippie scene as well.
Are you worried about moving out, like getting bought out here and having to go to San Jose or something?
Well, I'd hate to see that happen. We've got, fortunately, we have a very supportive neighborhood and a supportive landlord that's also a nonprofit, and they like the fact that we're here. Uh-huh. So we want to stay here for as long as we can. And right now, I don't anticipate any issues, but you never know what's going to happen. I mean, there was an art store down in the financial district whose rent went from $8,000 a month to $40,000 a month, if you can imagine. How do you do that?
Give me maybe top four or five items people, if they're like me, if they're on their way to the airport or like Penn, what do you have to see here?
Well, the really El Primo things that we have inside the museum, of course, is the car from the movie On the Road, which is pretty genuine and very cool. We have an original acid test card that we got from Ken Babbs. He was Ken Kesey's right-hand man in the bus.
And what does that card say?
It says, can you pass the acid test? And you would. It's like an identity card. It's like a club card. Yeah. You know, you put your name on it and a photograph. Over here, we've got Allen Ginsberg's organ that he used to write his music on when he would tour. Someone called us up one day and said, I've got Alan's organ. And it was a big joke, of course.
Yeah, of course.
and once we all stopped laughing, she verified that it was real, and Gary Snyder authenticated it. So we said, yeah, we'll take that. And she said, I'm going to travel for 2 years, and she never came back. I don't even know. This was 10 years ago. Mm. Jack Kerouac's jacket is right there. Mm. That was loaned to us by a guy who bought it at auction. We've got many, many signed documents. We've got original posters, some manuscripts, paintings, and photographs. A lot of great, cool stuff here. But this is a great way to build a museum because we're such a small organization, and we don't have a budget for acquisitions. But people give us things, which is pretty cool because they want to entrust it to someone that they know recognizes its value. Even if it's not worth a lot of money, it's cool to have a jacket that Jack Kerouac wore. Or it's cool to have, like, the ribbons and the banners that were on Jack Kerouac's grave when he was buried. We've got that in the archives. Somebody who was there gave it to us. You know, books signed by William S. Burroughs to John Cleland Holmes, things like that. Letters signed by those folks to one another. It's cool stuff. We're very grateful that we're supported the way we are.
What about the typewriter?
That particular typewriter doesn't have a real story as far as who owned it, but it's cool because it's an old Underwood number 5, and that would have been built and designed and sold like in 1910, and Jack would have written on those types of typewriter. He didn't write on that particular one, but the model exactly like it. We do have some typewriters in the archives that belong to some of the friends of the Beats, like Harold Norris and other people. We have Allen Ginsberg's typewriter downstairs. Mm-hmm. He owned many typewriters, of course. This would have been a 1960s model, like a portable typewriter. It's one of the things I really enjoy talking to young people about is you know, just like you've owned four or five computers already in your life, these guys have multiple typewriters. And then I try to help them understand how Jack invented an entire new technology for himself by writing the scroll on one huge long piece of paper. He was such a phenomenally fast typist that he would have to replace his paper every 2 or 3 minutes, and he designed this new form that was 15 feet long that would allow him to type for an hour.
It was all that coffee, wasn't it?
Yeah. Wink, wink. What they say.
Yeah. Jerry, you're the best.
Thanks, Dave.
You're so good at this.
Thank you. Nice seeing you again.
So thanks for taking your time out. Just roll all the specifics again, how people can help out, the address, website.
Yeah. So anyway, our website is Kerouac.com. We're located in North Beach in San Francisco, 540 Broadway, San Francisco. And if you want to learn about our upcoming Beat conferences, go to BeatnikShindig.com. That's a special website for that event.
Boy, you know, I started coming out here regularly in the 80s and stuff, but yeah, when you hear those stories about the 50s and 60s, I can only imagine what it would have been like.
It's a different time, you know. It really is a different time. And, you know, we're living through changing times, of course, and we're trying to keep the history alive.